Hi, this is Jessica Marpey, and I'm your moderator this evening. I am here with State Senator Art Haywood and his guest, and we want to welcome you to this live telephone town hall. If you have a question for the senator or his guest, press star 3 at any time on your phone's keypad. That's star 3 to submit a question to the senator or his guest. A reminder about tonight's discussion, this is a discussion about violence and public safety in Philadelphia. We will not take questions about cases, elections, campaigns, and we ask that questions are concise and to the point. Now, let's welcome Senator Art Haywood.
Thank you so much, Jessica, and thank you to everyone who is joining me on our telephone town hall tonight. We have until 8 o'clock. As you know, our telephone town halls are about 1 hour. Fortunately, we have a special guest, District Attorney Larry Krasner, who has been the District Attorney for the City of Philadelphia now for over 4 years. I would like to also share that District Attorney Krasner and his children and my children went to the same pre-K many, many years ago, obviously when I was much younger. But we're so glad that he's on and can provide some answers to questions, as well as share his perspective on gun violence and violence in Philadelphia. District Attorney Krasner, please introduce yourself and what you are doing to all of the callers from and listeners in the 4th Senate District.
I'm happy to do that, Senator. It's always a pleasure to be on with you. And for those of your listeners who do not know, Senator Haywood has been a real champion of prevention money and of money to try to deal with gun violence. He has been very successful statewide in getting resources that are helping Philadelphia right now. And I'm super grateful for that because I share his belief that prevention is one of the essential tools. So what am I doing? Well, first let me explain that the district attorney in any jurisdiction, the chief prosecutor in any jurisdiction, has the job of considering possible cases and prosecuting those cases. I am what they refer to as a progressive prosecutor. That means I'm a little bit different than the prosecutors in the past. And I say that because I think a lot of prosecutors in the past were driven by the idea of having more convictions, more arrests, more years in jail. And that meant for any offense. It meant for retail theft. It meant for jumping a turnstile. It meant for, you know, stealing change out of a car. With the same level of priority as it meant for shootings. I do not share that view, and neither do other progressive prosecutors. We believe that the focus, the emphasis, the energy, the effort should be going towards the most serious crimes, and those are things like shootings, killings by gun, the trade in illegal guns, felons possessing weapons while they are engaged in gang or group violence activity, first-degree felony rape, and other very serious offenses like gunpoint robbery, sexual assault, and so on. We believe in focusing on serious crime and separating that out from what are mostly crimes of poverty. We just think it's a bad use of resources to lock up a lot of people for minor stuff who don't need to be there when we could actually be putting those resources into prevention and into solving serious crimes, which we have a real struggle doing in Philadelphia, and then also prosecuting really serious crimes. So for all of you who are not aware, that is where I'm coming from, and I'm really delighted to have the chance to talk about this topic with you tonight.
Thank you so much. So now let's get to the callers so we can hear your questions. I do encourage short questions so that we can get as many callers on and the district attorney can answer as many questions as we can get on. I have asked the district attorney to provide some relatively brief answers, not superficial, but somewhat brief, just so we can get some more calls in. And so, Jessica, let's go to the callers.
Okay, sounds good. And before we do that, I just want to remind everyone on the phone that if you would like to submit a question, press star 3 and we will get you in our queue. First, we're going to go to Jimmy in Germantown. Jimmy, you are live with the Senator and District Attorney Krasner.
Hello.
Yes, Jimmy, go ahead.
Senator, it was a pleasure to talk to you. I called your guys' office. I was a Turnpike employee. I lost my job because of COVID, and they laid everybody off, over 750 people. And my question is, you guys got back to me, okay, and I'm going to make it real brief, but what I want to know is, what can we do to get more police walking the beat on the street, and what can we do as a community to start helping these young people out here to really find different sources and resources to become better adults? And me, myself, personally, I like to get involved, and I like to get involved in any type of programs that you have that could put me hands-on with people so that we can put an end to this and make Philadelphia a better place.
Thank you so much, Jimmy. Before District Attorney responds, I do have a quick response from my office. We have been supporting organizations that do mentoring throughout Northwest Philadelphia. We have been told by many young people and beyond that mentoring is a key need for young people at risk. So I encourage you to contact my office at 215-242-8171, and we can connect you with some of the organizations that are doing mentoring of young people in the Northwest. 215-242-8171. Let them know you're on this call, and we'll get you connected with folks who are daily and weekly in the lives of young people providing guidance. Having said that, though, I want to turn it over to District Attorney Krasner for how you see it.
First of all, Jimmy, thank you for those two questions. Those are actually great questions that go to the heart of some important issues. On the question of getting more police officers out of their vehicles and onto the street, that is not my lane in the sense that the DA's office does not control what the police department does. Now, I will tell you, I'm a fan of our police commissioner, Danielle Outlaw. We agree on an awful lot, not everything, but we agree on an awful lot. And I think that she has the potential to be a truly great police commissioner in Philadelphia, even in a troubled time. We have an example in Camden, and it's a very impressive example of what happened when, the police chief over there about 10 years ago started to stand up to a police union that had 100 reasons why you couldn't change anything. And the consequence was he did get police out of their cars, and they had a very serious downturn in homicides and a very serious upturn in their ability to solve gun violence. It's all for the reasons you know. I'm going to guess you know exactly why you want them out of their cars. It's because police officers can form relationships with people in the community even before something happens. They can get to know, Mrs. Smith, and they can get to know Michael on the corner. And the consequence is that as they develop that relationship, they are earning trust so that people start to tell them things that may be about to jump off. People give them information on a crime that already occurred. And guess what? The whole system works better. In Philly and in other places, because of the broken relationship between police and some communities, and it's not all police. We have a lot of great cops in Philly, but it is some of them. Because of that broken relationship, we very seldom have witnesses who we need for shooting cases and to help us solve cases. So that's really important. Second thing is, we would love to have you involved with some of our efforts. I would suggest you contact my chief of community outreach, a man who is a pastor, but he's also a police officer, and he is also an employee of the DA's office. His name is G. Lamar Stewart, and you can get a hold of him by emailing Stewart@phila.gov. He can give you more, but I will just briefly say this to you. City has set aside prevention money like they have not done in the past, which is encouraging. And Senator Haywood has been heavily involved in state efforts at prevention money. Thank you, Senator. My office has a little bit of forfeiture money. This is money taken from drug dealers, And we have been doing micro grants in Philadelphia because we understand how important it is to provide youth with alternatives. So at this point, we've given out about $800,000, much of it to small organizations that are doing great work. You know, people like Mighty Writers, which is a nonprofit that teaches kids all kinds of writing skills, or Kensington Soccer Club, which works with about 1,200 kids on soccer, but also on conflict resolution. We need more people who want to do that. And I'm grateful for your interest in being involved.
Thank you so much, Jimmy. Let's go to the next caller. Thank you, D.A. Krasner.
Great. Gina from Mount Airy, you are live.
Yes, hi. I had a question about the proliferation of guns in the city, and I wondered if anyone is investigating organized crime and how guns into the city. Because we know that 18-year-olds don't manufacture or sell or gun dealers. And then my other question is, has anyone taken steps to meet with the leaders of the gangs to try to help them resolve their conflicts in a peaceful way?
Senator, did you want to jump in, or you want me to?
That's for you.
Okay.
I think that's
so
for you.
Gina, thank you for the question. Yes, there are efforts that are ongoing to look for where guns are coming from, but here's the truth. 20 years ago, there were already too many guns in Philadelphia. Pennsylvania is known as a supply state for guns that are used in illegal ways throughout the East Coast, in the same way that Indiana supplies a lot of the gun violence in Chicago. Pennsylvania, because of its lax gun laws, and Philadelphia supplies New Jersey, supplies New York, which is pretty terrible. That's not what you want to be known as. Certainly, there are some people who are bringing in bunches of guns from the South in a rental truck and selling them on the street. But the reality is, if you look at the number of guns that are taken off the street, and the Philadelphia police are taking a lot of guns off the street, they're looking at about 6,000 this year. For every gun that's taken off the street, there are either two or three that are sold legally in stores in Philadelphia. So we are seeing a huge supply just coming through legal purchase, and then, of course, they're sold out the back door by a legal purchaser to people who are not able to buy, either because they have criminal records, mental health histories, or they're too young. So guns, sadly, are coming from many different directions, and the most dangerous and scariest new direction is what we call ghost guns. What that means is there are these kits you can buy. You can buy them on the internet. You can buy them at gun shows. One kit will be all plastic. It's about 80% plastic parts for a gun. The other kit will be the metal parts, like the maybe some of the firing mechanism. And somebody with a small tool can put together that gun, which has no serial numbers, no markings on it. They can put together that gun in about 10 or 15 minutes. Believe it or not, the law is that there are no background checks required, that you can walk in to a gun show and buy 125 of each type of kit for about $35,000. You can take them back and sell them for a hell of a lot more on the street. So unfortunately, we had a terrible supply of guns before we got started, more guns than people in the United States, more guns than people in Philadelphia. And it seems like even when we take a lot of guns off the street, the supply only increases through legal sources and through shadier sources like ghost guns and whatever guns are being smuggled in from other jurisdictions that may be the product of a theft from a gun shop or an illegal trade in guns. So we have a very, very serious problem with all of that. Now, Gina, you had a second question that was equally good, and I apologize. I just forgot what it was.
Her question was on, are you meeting with gang leaders?
Another. I mean, these are really great questions, and I'm not saying that to flatter you. They're just great questions. In a sense, we are, but not the most effective way. We have this thing called gun violence intervention, in which all the law enforcement partners are participating. The way that works is we know who these groups are. That doesn't mean we know everybody in them. But we know many of the people who are in these different groups that are at war, you know, Brickyard Mafia, 10th and Brown, et cetera. And so the ones who are on probation or parole, every now and then will be called into a room, and they will be reminded and notified that if their group is involved with gun violence, that there's going to be a swift response from law enforcement. And they're simultaneously offered a lot of services to try to give them employment, treatment, whatever it is that they may need to go a different direction, right? That is a way of doing it. It's shown a little bit of success around the country. We're trying it in Philly at a tough time. But I think what you're talking about may point more to what something they did in Seattle a while back, which they referred to as a peace circle. And what they tried to do there is a very experienced prosecutor, the chief prosecutor, Dan Satterberg, was frustrated because their gun prosecutions of gangs continued, but they didn't seem to reduce violence. And so he decided to get people who were members of groups that were at odds with each other into a circle and have conversations and try to shut down some of the conflict, some of the violence, try to settle the beef, as it were. It was an approach that did show some success. It was a more restorative kind of an approach. And it's the kind of thing that, you know, I would be very supportive of in Philadelphia, but we do not have a structure together that could do that that's official. Now, there are some people on the street who do this quietly and privately. They're called violence interrupters in some places. Some of the mosques are involved in similar activity. And for obvious reasons, they may not want everybody in law enforcement to know who's coming into the building at what time and date to have what conversation. You know, they have to have a level of trust to do their work that is somewhat inconsistent with law enforcement knowing everything that they're doing. But, you know, we applaud the work of doing that, and I am 100% open. We're the first administration in Philly that has been willing to do restorative justice resolution of criminal cases. We're doing it for juveniles now with great success, and we do believe that there are restorative models that may be very effective in reducing violence by getting some of the leaders of these groups into a room.
Thank you so much, Gina. Thank you so much, D.A. Krasner. I also want to share that we've been fortunate in the Northwest to have a group called Philadelphia Ceasefire, and they've been effective throughout the areas where they are involved in talking to people who are just got shot in hospitals, try to encourage them not to retaliate. Retaliation is a big source of this violence. And Philly Ceasefire got a $300,000 grant from the state, which I think will help us in the Northwest so they can interrupt some of the violence. But yes, we got a long way to go. Let's go. Thanks for the question and response. Let's go to the next caller.
Great. We actually have a caller that doesn't want to go live. Her name's Tanya, but she wants to know if there's a place for people to anonymously drop off guns.
What a great – I'm sorry. Go ahead, Senator.
Yeah. So there are gun drop-off events and gun buyback events that are periodically in the Northwest. However – individuals can certainly drop off a gun at the 14th Police District office. I know the 14th Police District will receive guns. And so that would be the location that I would recommend for anyone who wants to drop off a gun.
All right, we can go to our next caller. Antoinette, you are live.
Hello.
Hi, you're live. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Antoinette. I'm calling from Oakland, the Northwest.
Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yes, as I stated, I really wish the mayor was on. I wanted to know about the DA, do you have a program that goes into the schools that can actually hit children before they become adults, say 17, 18? So do we have a program for that goes into our public schools and talk to our students that maybe we can get to change their mindset, some type of program? I know the mayor gave out all this money to all these community organizations, but I don't feel as though it's going to hit who it needs to, because they're not going to come to a meeting. These people that are killing each other, they're not going to stop and go to a community meeting. They're not going to stop and go to POW or whatever. We need something that is in their face all the time and a consistent message. Do we have a DA program that goes into the public schools?
Antoinette, thank you for that question. That is a great question, and I share your vision, your view, that that can make a difference. The short answer is yes, we do. Our Chief of Community Outreach, G. Lamar Stewart, who I mentioned earlier, runs a community outreach team, and that team goes regularly into several public schools. They will do it proactively before something bad happens, but they also go very frequently when there has been a student in that school who has been killed in gun violence. And the topics they cover include everything around gun violence. It includes, obviously, stuff that is intended to keep them on the right track, doing their homework, headed for a career, thinking about college or a trade school. It also includes talking about criminal justice issues and listening to them. And, you know, we have found that it's something that they and their principals really appreciate, and we appreciate them because we learn so much from them when we do that. But that, you know, we're very serious about that and consistent with our resources. We go into a lot of schools. There are some schools, and math and science is just one of them, where we have probably been, you know, 7-8 times over the course of a couple years. For a lot of reasons, some of them good, some of them bad. But yes, we are big believers in that. I'm not here to say that the DA's office is necessarily the best one to go in. You know, we're not professional educators, but we are delighted to work with professional educators. And I think you're 100% on the right track, that we have to show young people that they have a future. We have to show them things that are positive, that will get their attention when they are dealing, they're almost dealing with a pornography of violence all the time on their, you know, on their social media. And we think it's very important to reach out to them while they are in school.
Thank you so much, Antoinette. I also do want to share that some of the organizations that are being funded include formerly incarcerated individuals who have had a life that was at risk, and they are talking to young people to try to encourage them to reject the life that they had. Second, some of these organizations are talking to young people and offering them jobs and an alternative lifestyle away from crime. So I don't want you to leave thinking that it's all about group meetings regarding peace. Some of these organizations are really individuals who have lived that life trying to encourage young people to take another path. All right, let's keep going. We're doing great.
Great. Before we continue, I just want to remind all of our callers that if you would like to submit a question in tonight's discussion, press *3 to submit your question. That's *3. Next, we'll go to Wayne in Mount Airy. Wayne, you are live.
Yeah, thank you. I kind of heard the answer to my question, but, you know, suggesting my wife is from Jamaica, and I seen they had, like, Army and police force checkpoints, especially, like, in Kensington, because I drove a cab for 40 years. You can see the drug and the gun activity in there. Is there any kind of new method they need, like, enforced to, you know, control the gun and the violence?
Well, Wayne, thank you for that question. It is a great question. So there is new technology that I think can make a huge difference. And unfortunately, Philadelphia has not invested in forensic technology, meaning the technology you need to solve crimes. We've not invested in it the way other cities in America have. As you may know, you know, DNA, people's genetic makeup, has become a very important tool in determining whether people are innocent or guilty. And in the same way, there are certain things that can be done with DNA and guns that never could have been done before that could actually be really, really important in solving a lot more cases. I think that's the way to do it. There also is technology that's very good at using our cell phones, not only to track communications or to recover communications, but also to track location. You know, we have cases all the time where a defendant is claiming not to have been at a shooting. The problem is that defendant's phone went right up to where the shooting was right before the shooting and ran the other direction right after the shooting. That is a very important piece of evidence that allows us to take a closer look and see whether the claim that the defendant was not there is true. So what we really need to do in Philly, among other things, is we need a state-of-the-art forensics lab. It doesn't actually cost that much. We could have a national standard state-of-the-art lab with the capacity to do all of the evidence that is collected where we can get some kind of forensic results. We could do that for about 5% of the police budget. And I mean 5% in 1 year could build the whole thing, and it could fund the whole thing, and then it would just be a tiny amount year after year to do the work, probably something like 1% of the police budget. But unfortunately, it's not what we have done. We're so used to just putting more money into policing, and it becomes more cars, which has some value. It becomes more officers on the street when they're out of the car, which does have some value. We're not getting as much value out of all the money that we spend on policing as we would if we would use modern science. You start solving shootings at the first one before you have the retaliatory shooting and the next retaliatory shooting and the next retaliatory shooting, you can save a lot of lives and we could solve a lot of cases. People who know they're going to get caught don't want to shoot. That's just reality. But at the moment, what we're looking at is a solve rate that's only about 15% for non-fatal shootings. And even though the rate for homicides is up around 40%, the rate for homicides by gun is lower. It's in the 20%, according to the data I've seen. If you think you got a 3 out of 4 chance of not being caught or an 8.5 out of 10 chance of not being caught, you're more likely to do something terrible than if you think I'm getting caught. So maybe I'll go do something else today.
Great question and response. I did have a question myself. I've been talking to a number of individuals about a gun violence prevention strategy and the need for one, maybe not doing what's done in LA or some other cities. And I know that you recently talked about some strategies that your office was developing and thinking about. What can you share with us about the work of your office and what we might be able to expect from your research and the research of your office?
Well, we have, you know, we are blessed with a data lab. The DA's office never had a criminologist in it, meaning a scientist of crime, in it before our administration. We hired one, and through his good work, we were able to line up a bunch of foundation money. We now have a team of about 15 people who are working off a grant. None of this is tax money. This is grant money coming from the outside. And they do all kinds of different data analyses, including things like, you know, let's map where all the shootings happen. Let's map where they are in relation to bars. Let's map the hour of the day when this happens. Oh, look, it seems to happen right after the bars close a lot. So what strategy could we have to change that, either in terms of policing or maybe in terms of having bars close at different hours? You know, what could we do? That's just a tiny example of the kind of stuff that they are up to. You know, take a look at poverty. How does poverty connect to violence? It's a very, very direct and long-lasting connection. How could changing other structural things change that? So they work on all of those sorts of things, and then they work on stuff that's just more, you know, just more like routine stuff. What's the solve rate? What's our conviction rate? You know, how many of these cases were lost because of a missing civilian witness who would never come in? How many of them were lost because a lawyer goofed up or a judge goofed up or the police officers were subpoenaed but didn't show up? So, you know, we work pretty hard on trying to see exactly what part of this car is working, what part of this car needs to be replaced, what part needs to be fixed, and we're able to do it in that fashion. Part of our work is in collaboration with the Philadelphia Police Department, who have their own data team, and we do meet on a very regular basis. I have a lot of communications with the commissioner, but we also have experts in the police department and in the DA's office who are in communication on a weekly basis. I will tell you, though, one of my biggest frustrations is there is a lot of talk in the city, and, you know, it's talk within city government about gun violence, and rightly so. But, you know, when we show up and say we need a little bit of money to do it, we're stretching. We're putting 25 attorneys into stuff the office has never done before to try to knock back gun violence. I have to tell you, I'm kind of frustrated because there's a lot of words, but not always any dollars. You know, you know what your government really wants when you see how it spends its money. And it's not always the prettiest picture. And once again, I want to say that is something that's really special about Senator Stewart, because he went and got it. He went and got money, and that means something.
Thanks so much. So let's go back to the callers.
Great. Next we have Thurman from West Oak Lane. Thurman, you are live.
Yes. How you doing, Senator? As you know, they're trying to pass it where you can get purchase a gun without a permit. But if this goes in effect, will Philadelphia be able to make their own laws on that, where if they do that, that if a person purchases a gun, that can it be, even if they have a permit or not, can there be a ballistic test created by the district attorney's office for each individual gun sold before the person's able to buy it? So at least they have some way to track down who purchased the gun.
Let me respond. Thanks so much. Let me respond to what's happening in Harrisburg in terms of the laws that the state and the city of Philadelphia must follow currently. First, there is no permit required to purchase a gun. None. That does not exist in Pennsylvania. I have legislation to make it happen, but it hasn't passed. So we do not have any requirement for a permit to purchase. Number two, what recently happened is Republicans passed legislation, or they will finish passing it, so that you do not have to have a permit for a concealed weapon. For the last 50 years, we have required a permit, special interrogation, reputation check, before you could get a concealed weapon. However, there's an effort to eliminate that. I am confident, though, however, that Governor Wolf will stop that legislation in its tracks, but there's a lot of pressure from the people that I call the guns everywhere folks. And the guns everywhere folks don't want permits, even for concealed weapons. With respect to ballistic testing, currently there's no requirement for anything like that before you purchase. The only thing that's required before purchase is a background check, but nothing that is with respect to ballistics on a gun. Now, there may be some DA Krasner, you may be able to give us some advice about how the ballistic tests work or don't work, or why ballistic tests are relevant at all.
Yes, I'm happy to do that. So let me just add to what Senator Haywood said, that the United States Supreme Court, which at this point is a very pro-gun court and in general has been very anti-gun regulation because it's a very conservative Republican court, but they are getting ready to consider some gun regulation in New York having to do with carrying guns. And a lot of people are concerned that the U.S. Supreme Court is going to make it even easier to have guns without permits. We will have to see how that shakes out. If you want to know my opinion of how the United States Supreme Court has addressed the gun issue, I think it's a disgrace. I think their interpretations of the Second Amendment, which gives the right to possess guns, have been way off base for literally more than 100 years, and it has endangered all of us. We've become a country with more guns than people. If you look at other countries where they have reasonable gun regulation, the rate of homicide by gun is so much lower. So that, you know, that is an aspect of it. In terms of your question with reference to ballistics, ballistic evidence is incredibly helpful when it is available. And the National Rifle Association, which is the great villain of this whole thing, has done pretty much everything they can to make it hard to trace guns from the point of sale, to sue gun manufacturers, which they've done by making it hard to look at it, to do any research around guns. It's very, very limited. Part of what goes with all of this is that every time a big city like Philly or New York tries to pass regulations to protect its residents, they are overcome because state legislatures tend to be more rural, more Republican, more pro-gun, And the law in general has been that a city cannot do what a state does not allow. Right? So Philly, on a number of occasions, has actually tried to come with really thoughtful, helpful legislation, but under a legal doctrine they call preemption, what it boils down to is the city can't make people do what the state doesn't make people do. And since the state legislature, unlike Senator Haywood, who's very sensible on these issues, the state legislature is in favor of guns for everybody, probably including babies in diapers, Philadelphia is frustrated all the time when we try to come up with sensible stuff. What you are speaking of, sir, makes a heck of a lot of sense. It would be delightful if Philadelphia could require all kinds of testing to be done on guns before they're even sold and put into permanent databases. That would make a ton of sense. We would probably pass four or five other regulations that would make Philadelphia safer, but simply put, we're not allowed. When we pass them, they get struck down by courts that are going by state law. And that state law, as you can tell, even now, in the middle of a terrible gun violence crisis, goes towards letting everybody have guns all the time, the guns everywhere crowd.
Thanks so much. Let's keep the calls coming.
All right, let's go to Vaughn from Germantown. Vaughn, you are live.
Hi, good evening, everyone. Thank you for having this panel, and thank you for hearing my question. So my question is, you know, over the last 4 years and even now with the rise of social media and obviously a gun violence epidemic, when I just look at extreme things like the rise of gun violence, economics absolutely plays into it. But as part of these outreach programs, you know, we know from research and heard out loud from reports that social media has radicalized people to act and take action. I mean, January 6th obviously was a very overt example of that. Gun violence, I suspect, is probably something very similar in which there could be potential radicalization that's happening on social media. In the outreach efforts in the DA's office in Philadelphia, is there anything that talks about social media radicalization and the intersection of gun violence?
We don't have a bad question tonight. This is great. So Vaughn, you raise a super important point. There's so many levels to it, but I'm going to try to be concise. Number one, more and more, we are seeing that social media is actually a part of the story of the killing. And we're seeing that because what is going on is that groups have a beef with other groups that may go back 15 years over a shooting that happened long ago. But it's been going on for a period of time. And what is happening at this point is you will have one group mocking the other group on social media, either musically or verbally, and there will be immediate retaliation. You'll have one group beat up a member of the other group, video it, and put it out there forever. So the humiliation goes on forever. And then there will be retaliation, because the only way that individual or that group thinks they can reclaim their respect, and their respect is in some instances really the only thing they feel that they have, is violence. It's to retaliate. So we see shootings followed by bragging about the shooting and mocking the person who was shot. And then we see the people who are actually in the process of shooting that social media getting shot because the other side figured out where they were since they're live streaming. Like, I'm not making this up. This is real. In the 1960s, they talked about, you know, domestic killings. And later, we saw the primary motivation, killings over drug turf. This is a new phenomenon. The only way I regain my self-respect is by killing you, or I'm going to, you know, I mean, honestly, some people are trying to score a recording deal. And the recording deal appears to be more attractive if it's involved with people who are actually engaging in violent activity with a group and are in the middle of a beef. I know it's terrible to say that, but you all know that what I'm talking about has its real history. So, you know, that is a big part of it. What are we doing? One of the things that we did after meeting with some young people who told us really fascinating and awful stuff about how their phones ding several times a day when there's a shooting in the area, you can go on a couple of different apps and then you can see crime scene photos. And if you pay an extra $10, you can see the close-ups of the crime scene photos. Sometimes they're watching videos of the homicide. And sometimes it even involves someone they know being killed or involved in the shooting. These were actually good kids telling us this stuff. They came from relatively stable homes. They were involved in their own faith community.
They were headed for college, but they nonetheless live in areas where this was going on. And just as a matter of knowing the news, knowing what was happening in their neighborhood, being safe themselves, they were subjecting themselves to what is almost a violence pornography, where they were desensitized to it and they were seeing it. So the phenomenon you're talking about is real. When we heard that, our immediate response was, you know, there has to be an answer to this. And the answer needs to be using some of the important social media influencers to put out something that is more attractive, more exciting. People are, in fact, drawn to things like sex and violence. They're drawn to conflict. This is one of the terrible things about social media, because it basically is all built on an algorithm of keep people looking as long as possible. So if you show them things that are sensational or horrible or false, but exciting, they'll just keep looking at it. So we did gather together a few people heavily involved in social media. These are people whose abilities are organic. They just came up on the street and they have big followings. We even invited Wallo. For those of you who don't know who Wallo215 is, this is a guy who has more than 1 million followers in Philadelphia after having been in jail for a considerable period of time. Once said to me that he viewed himself as the Anthony Bourdain of urban social media. We need to work with people like that to put out messages that are exciting and interesting and that present a positive future, that do not desensitize, that do not humiliate. We need to work with that and have a conflicting positive message. That's part of it. But I would also like to think that we could do something with our regulation of social media, given that they finally, eventually, much too late, shut off the liar in chief, Donald Trump, so that he wasn't constantly poisoning the brains of susceptible people. We need to do something about what is being done on social media in terms of violence, threats of violence, bragging about violence, encouraging violence. We need to do something there.
Thanks so much. Great questions from all the callers. Who's next?
We have a question from a caller that doesn't want to go live again. This one is from Betty. She wants to know if there are any programs to deal with trauma in the community. She's seeing lots of unaddressed mental trauma in the Black community, and she would love for that to be addressed.
Yeah, thanks so much. And one thing we have seen through the COVID-19 pandemic is what people also call a mental health pandemic. And this mental health pandemic is, I think, largely related to stresses that people had before the pandemic that were further aggravated by loss of jobs and loss of life, all that we had during COVID-19. The mental health resources for our community are desperately lacking. I will share with you that there's a lot of recognition that trauma is in the community, that trauma should be addressed in the community. I've been in many conversations where that's been said over and over again. But we currently do not have the dollars allocated to the programs that provide mental health assistance. And just like we need more assistance for those who are doing mentoring so they can be more effective, we definitely need more resources for the organizations that are involved in addressing trauma and the mental health needs of the community. So you have identified a core part of the solution, but we've got to get it ramped up, well-organized, and well-funded, and we've got significant distance to go to get that done.
You know, let me just add, if I may, I think that's a great question. Important to recognize, I mean, yes, our office does direct victims and witnesses and people in the community who have experienced trauma towards treatment, because we know for a fact that people whose trauma is not addressed often do themselves act out the violence that they witnessed. It is very common that people who've seen hardcore domestic abuse in the home, if it is not addressed, will later try to take control over that lack of control they felt by committing violence themselves. It is seen over and over. Hurt people is a phrase, but it's also, having said that, I think it's important to recognize that during the period of the increase of mass incarceration, and the United States is the most locked up incarcerated country in the world, but during that 30, 40 year history dating back to the late 1970s, we dismantled our mental health system about 85%. We took the money that we had in a mental health system and we put it into jails. And they're not going to fix anything. You know, this is one of the great tragedies of this lock everything up and throw away the key approach, is that it hasn't made us safer at all. And in fact, what it's done is it's stripped away the kinds of treatment that we needed for things like drug abuse, for things like mental health. There is absolutely no question in my mind that if we were to seriously invest in addressing trauma that is being suffered by people in communities where there's high levels of gun violence, we would see drastic improvements. And that's only one reason we should do it. We should also do it because it's the right thing to do, and because human beings should be taken care of.
Thanks so much. Now we're getting into our last 10 minutes or so, so we'll get a few more questions in. Thanks for all who have been patient with their questions. We'll get as many in as we can, but as you may know, you'll get an opportunity to leave your question on our voicemail should we be unable to get to it. But Jessica, who's the next caller?
We're going to go to Philip in Mount Airy. Philip, you are live.
Hi there. I have two quick questions. One is around the comment around the number of guns in Philadelphia. And my first question is around the state of Wyoming, for example, has huge gun ownership, lots of guns, that sort of thing, but doesn't seem to have the same type or amount of crime. What do you think the difference is? They have lots of guns, we have lots of guns, but we have a lot more crime. And then my second question is, around the number of arrests that the Philadelphia Police Department has made this year for illegal guns and possession of illegal guns, which is up for the year, which is great, getting them off the streets and that sort of thing. But the conviction rate seems to be lower this year. So I just want to see like what the disparity is there.
Thanks for the question, Philip.
Yeah, let me answer those. And thank you. Those are great questions, Philip. I really appreciate it. So question two, conviction rate in the courts in the last 2 years is completely unprecedented, not only in my 34-year career, but in the last century plus, which is you never shut down a court system and you never profoundly change policing and probation and parole and everything that's done in criminal justice the way it has been. We effectively shut the courts during the pandemic. Even now, they're not wide open. They're probably only at about 40% or 50% open. I tell you this to tell you that we are actually having very good success at getting gun arrest cases past the preliminary hearing, which is the first step, and ready for trial. But we can't finish the trials because right now, due to the pandemic and due to the necessity of being safe in courthouses, the court system, and this, by the way, is not controlled by me. It's controlled by the leadership in the courts. The court system is not wide open. You know, it used to take one courtroom to have people could sit near each other, and now it takes three. And that means we have a very limited flow. So if you simply look at what the conviction rate is, you're going to see a low number. But the real reason for that is that we have a ton of cases that are ready to go to trial, but they cannot go to trial yet. So you'll see, for example, that we might have 85% of our cases get past a preliminary hearing, which is a very high rate. And no case is perfect, so there certainly are always going to be some cases that are getting chucked out for good reasons. Now, we have this huge backlog of cases that are not done, but very few cases that actually get to trial. If you were to look, so what you're looking at is you're seeing some cases thrown out early, most cases doing really well, and it gives you a distorted number. If you actually look at the number of cases that have gone to trial, what you'll see, for example, is, you know, 74 wins and 4 losses. Well, that's an extremely high conviction rate if you look at the ones that got the trial. But if you compare that to this whole bunch of cases that have not gotten to trial, or that bunch of cases, that relatively low percent, that's still a big number, that got dismissed early, you get distorted statistics. That's all going to clear up, and it's all going to improve as the courts get more and more open. And hopefully, if COVID abates, we'll be able to do that. Your second question is about Wyoming. Just so you know, I think it's Philip, right? You're talking, you are speaking to someone, the DA of Philadelphia, who has a ton of hunters in the family, some of them from the Southwest, others who have been hunting in places like South Dakota and Wyoming. I have a hunter safety certificate myself, and I've been hunting. One of the least dense states in the United States. It's very few people and much, much, much land. And I am fairly certain if you check, you'll find that overwhelmingly you're talking about rifles and you're talking about hunters and you're talking about ranchers and you're talking about people who are completely spread out. That is a totally different dynamic than when you have a lot of handguns and you have them in a very dense urban population. That conclusion is borne out by all sorts of FBI statistics, including the following. And that is that, you know, while gun violence went up all over the country in 2020, the national increase was very high. It was 20%. The average increase in the 50 largest cities was 42%. And it was 40% in Philadelphia. It is and always has been a fact that in denser, high population environments, you have higher levels of gun violence. And it's also always been a fact that homicides and illegal gun violence are much more related to handguns than they are to rifles. Now, I don't pretend to be a criminologist and have all the answers for you, but I think that is a big part of it.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Jessica, it does look like we may have a question or two that were submitted online. I don't want to completely ignore those who may have had a question submitted online. Is there any one of those that we can take?
Sure, we could go to Barbara's question. Barbara asked, do you believe that community trust would help in solving gun crimes before the escalating retaliations? If so, what can be done to build that trust?
I can give a real concise answer here. Go ahead, Senator.
Go ahead.
Absolutely. Community trust is one of the biggest problems we have. And what happens when you have distrust and hatred between police and the community they serve, and it doesn't necessarily, you know, there's a lot of great cops, but it comes from things like Frank Rizzo, his legacy of brutality and racism. It comes from things like illegal stop and frisk. Thank you, Rudy Giuliani. When you break down that trust, so nobody in that community wants to become a cop, even the people who might have before they got, you know, illegally searched four times, you don't have witnesses. The biggest problem that we have as prosecutors is we get a case and the investigation ain't that great because everybody in the neighborhood said, I didn't see nothing. And the person who got shot says, I'm not talking. And the people who might come forward who actually made the 911 calls cannot be found, right? How do you restore it? Well, one thing you do is you get innocent people out of jail and you solve old cases and put guilty people who've done terrible things in jail. And then they start to think, you actually care. You actually want the truth. You actually want to get at it. That's something that we have done, and our office is improving the trust that prosecutors have with the community, a trust that they broke. This is not just a policing issue. It's also a prosecution issue. I think to the extent that we get police officers out of their cars, to the extent that we have police officers who actually live in Philadelphia and are from Philadelphia and can connect and relate to their community to the extent that they have studied social work, they have been trained in a certain way that is less militaristic, to the extent that they are not themselves hooked into a police union whose leadership is clearly racist and white supremacist. And I'm not talking about the membership. I said the leadership. I'm talking about John McNesby, a man who's been very clear. He's A-OK with Nazi tattoos on cops, and he's A-OK calling Black Lives Matter, quote, a pack of rabid animals, unquote. To the extent police are different than that image, then they will be more trusted, and we will be able to solve more cases, prevent more cases, prosecute successfully more cases.
Yeah, thank you so much for that question. And I will say that there are a number of things that can be done to build community trust, some of which have been described from D.A. Krasner. There are activities that the police department has to have the police athletic league, to be in touch with young people. And there's a lot of things that could be done. I also want to say that there are individuals who have information about a crime that are really afraid to share that information. They're afraid that they'll be retaliated against and lose their lives, lose their livelihoods. I know that there's been some level of relocation program so that individuals can be, in some instances, relocated. But that's a challenging thing as well, to be relocated from your own neighborhood to another place. So this fear of injury by cooperating with the police is something we really have to figure out how we can address. This fear is big. I've been in a number of community meetings where individuals have come straight up to me after the meeting and said, I can't say what I know because I will be shot. So that's a real challenge we have. Thanks for raising it. I mean, thanks so much for raising it. Now, it looks like it's 7:58, so do we, I do want to share a couple quick things. I did mention that guns could be dropped off at the 14th Police District. That is located at 43 West Haynes Street. 43 West Haynes, pretty much Haynes and Germantown Avenue, right around the corner is where you can drop off guns. 43 West Haynes Street. Also, for those who are willing, there is an anonymous tip line from the Philadelphia Police Department. And that number is 215-686-8477. 215-686-8477. I think, Jessica and D.A. Krasner, that we're probably out of time. And so, Jessica, is that your view as well? It looks like it's 7:59.
Yep, I think we are out of time. But like you mentioned, for those who did stay on the line and did not get to submit their question, you will be able to submit it via voicemail at the end of this call, and then the senator will be able to hear your question, even though we didn't get to it today. So any final remarks from you, Senator, or District Attorney Krasner?
Well, I
want to say, number one, what great questions, and number two, thank you, Senator, for everything you do, including this town hall. It is wonderful to see so many Philadelphians interested and willing to contribute their time to this conversation.
Thank you so much, and thank you for everyone who participate in our telephone town hall discussion, to those who listen in and those who ask questions. Special thank you to DA Larry Krasner. This event, I believe, will help build some of the trust that was described that is somewhat lacking, and it will take outreach being available, events like this, to help restore trust. If you didn't have a chance to ask your question, please remain on the line. You'll be able to leave your question on a voicemail for me, and we will get back to you. Thank you again for your participation. If you have any questions or concerns, please call my office at 215-242-8171. You can also visit my website at senatorhaywood.com. Have a good evening.
Thank you for participating in Senator Art Haywood's Telephone Town Hall. You have been a great audience. Have a great evening.